Blog Talk Radio.
It's only been a few days since we last talked. I was then in Mongolia. Today I am in Hong Kong. And, you know, last time I talked to you, I was kind of happy because one of my videos, a video that Turning Point USA had taken and kind of shortened and spliced up a little bit, had gone viral. I think at the time it had like a million views. On Facebook, and I was pretty happy. Well, since then, in just, you know, 2-3 days, the count is now up to 3.44 million views. With last time I looked, there were over 50,000 shares. It's probably more than that now. Well over 4,000 comments, and you know, going strong. So who knows where this video will end up? It's certainly the progress has slowed as these viral thing happens. It's a phenomenon of a few days, and then it kind of peters out. So it's been between 3 to 3.5 million in the last 24 hours. But cool, my first real viral video. This is real viral. This isn't just a semi-viral. This is the real thing. Well, thanks for listening. I know these change of hours and change of days and is kind of difficult to for everybody to follow. Of course, some of you are listening not live, are listening to the podcast. So thank you guys, but it's good to have some live people on this. I guess in the U.S., Friday night here in Hong Kong, Saturday morning, I'm looking out the window and looking at probably the most stunning, striking, impressive skyline in the world. Sorry, New York. Don't cut it anymore. It's Hong Kong. Hong Kong has more skyscrapers than New York City, more skyscrapers than any city in the world. I'm sitting in a skyscraper on one side of the bay, looking across the bay onto the island of Hong Kong and the skyscrapers on that side. Indeed, the fourth tallest building in the world is right next to me. It's an office building, I guess some condos, and then a hotel at the top. Next time I come to Hong Kong, I'm going to stay at that hotel. It's the Ritz-Carlton, so we'll see. We'll see if I can pull that one off. Maybe save up a little money for the next trip. But literally, I'm looking across, and one of the things that makes Hong Kong so beautiful is not just the skyline, but behind the skyline is a mountain. So you get these skyscrapers with a mountain behind it. You get a water in front of it with boats going back and forth. As I've said many times in my lectures, if you've never been to Hong Kong, do yourself a favor. This is my fifth visit. It impresses me every single time. And it's not just the skyline. It's the hustle and bustle and energy and excitement. And it's the beautiful malls, the shopping malls. And not that I'm a shopper, because I'm not a shopper. It's you know, how impressed I am with shopping malls, the wealth, the cleanliness, the beauty, and there's so many of them here in Hong Kong that you really get a sense of real wealth. And look, this is an amazing story. Hong Kong is 75 years ago, fishing village. Today, 7.5 million people living on this island. The government of Hong Kong over that period has offered very little to the millions of immigrants who have come here, other than freedom. Basically, respect for contracts, respect for property rights, and opportunities galore. Not opportunities created by the government. Opportunities created because the government is not destroying them. Opportunities created because the government is not getting in the way of entrepreneurs and business leaders and financiers who are facilitating those opportunities. Unfortunately, that Hong Kong, you know, arguably is in decay. is disappearing. So we'll talk about that a little bit. Everybody I talk to here is pretty pessimistic about the direction Hong Kong is taking and what people want. Also, it's interesting because I got a question last night at an event. What is more valuable, economic freedom or political freedom? So think about that for a minute. What is more valuable, economic freedom, political freedom? That's kind of an interesting question, and a question that Hong Kong is grappling with, a question China is grappling with, a question Singapore obviously is grappling with, and I think the rest of the world is, as democracy, majority rule, the rule of the mob seems to be destroying many countries and getting many countries into trouble. Not the least is really the United States of America, which has become over the decades, over the last two centuries, has become from a constitutional republic, has turned into a democracy. So, you know, Hong Kong's amazing, beautiful. You know, I really wish I had more time kind of just to walk around and to hang out. But the 2 days in Hong Kong have been intense, full of work, full of meetings, full of did two interviews, did a radio interview, did a magazine interview. Today, maybe I'll go up the mountain just to catch the view, although it's very cloudy and might rain soon. But would love to have more time to walk around Hong Kong, and I think all of you should do the same thing. Come to Hong Kong, definitely worth a visit. If you've been once, come again. If you've been a long time ago, come again, because it keeps growing, it keeps developing, new skyscrapers. People are saying the harbor keeps getting smaller, because in Hong Kong they're not embarrassed, they're not constrained. And so they seem to be, pouring in a sense, growing the land at the expense of the harbor. They keep pouring soil and concrete and stuff into the harbor and reclaiming it for construction. And you get new high rises going up. There's still some massive construction going on, although less so than past visits that I've been here. So I think Hong Kong is changing, not for the better. I think the demand for more democracy and the demand for more government intervention and the demand for a bigger safety net and the demand for more regulation and coming both from Hong Kong citizens and from the Hong Kong mainland is slowly chipping away at what made Hong Kong great. By the way, the viral video, the video that got 3.5 million views. I still can't get my head around that exactly. And help spread it. Keep spreading it. You know, if you guys have got a copy of the video, you know, keep sharing it. Who knows how many more views we can get. And make sure my name's on it, because in the video itself, it doesn't mention who I am. It doesn't mention who the speaker is. But make sure to tag me or to put my name somewhere so people know who to follow, and encourage people to follow me. I've got quite a bit of increase in following on Facebook in the last few days because of that video. So that's nice. I think I got 1,000 new followers this week. So that's pretty cool. Let's see, what am I up to on Facebook? I think it's 17,285 people like my page on Facebook. That's a good thing. 17,000 people follow me. So we'd like to grow that. So tag it, share it, continue the process. Thank you again to Turning Point USA for creating the video. Next time you do it, please make sure, at least at the end of the video, to say who the speaker is. That would be good. Those of you who want to create videos like this, feel free. So generally, anything of mine on YouTube, do whatever you want with. Now, do whatever you want with is a little strong. Do whatever you want that's respectful with. Please don't create videos that make me look stupid, make me look bad. But if you want to take a video, put subtitles on it, put flashy graphics on it, trim it down to 3 minutes, get it out there. If you want to look at the kind of video that goes viral, look at what Turning Point USA did. If any of you want to volunteer your efforts to help the Ironman Institute, to help me, to help these ideas, get out there into the public, get out there to a large number of people, then feel free to do that. Now, we will be at ARI starting to do this as well. We're going to hire somebody to make such videos. But of course, hiring somebody costs money. So if you want to help us hire somebody, write a check to the Ayn Rand Institute. We can't hire people unless we get contributions. So we are completely dependent on your guys' support. We're your agents. But of course, you can volunteer your time. Many of you can't write big checks. And many can't help us significantly hire somebody, but you can volunteer your time. And one way to volunteer your time is to take these videos, create memes, create videos, and get them out there. Get them. Social media is a fantastic mechanism to distribute ideas. It's a fantastic mechanism to tease people, to get people engaged. A lot of people who watched that 3-minute video of me, which is, by the way, 2 years old, it was taped in Exeter, England, when I did my Equal is Unfair lecture there. So it's a 2-year-old video. It doesn't matter. Many of the people, and by the way, the reason Turning Point got a hold of that video is because an objectivist, I think it was Eric, an objectivist took that Exeter video, created a 6-minute video, and then what Turning Point, and that did very well. It got like 100,000 views. And then what Turning Point did is it took that 6-minute video, cut it down to 3 minutes, and created the subtitles and the graphics and so on. And that's what went viral. So without Eric turning the big video, my total lecture, into this Q&A, Turning Point USA would have never found the video and they would have never done it. So it's all due to one of our listeners here to the show and one of our supporters at the Institute and a longtime objectivist. So it's due to him that all of this happened. So thank you. And but that's a lesson, right? You might do something, it might not go viral, but somebody else might see it, might do something different to it, might spin it a different way, and off it goes and becomes something really, really, really substantial. So don't give up on these things. So those of you who like to play around with video, those of you who are so inclined, this is not a duty, it's not an obligation, your moral responsibility. I'm not going to use guilt on you, although I'm tempted. I'm really, really tempted. You know, it's the Jewish heritage in me to try to guilt you into doing this. But if you're so inclined and if you enjoy these things and if you know how to do it, I, for example, have no idea how to do it. I could probably learn, but I have no idea how to do it. But if you know how to do it. I know that Jeremy Kidder has done a lot of this from my talk in Seoul. And has created a bunch of these a bunch of short videos from my talk in Seoul, and hopefully some of those will go viral. They're in the thousands, and I know Jeremy's on the chat and listening to the show live right now. So thank you, Jeremy, for doing that. And again, who knows who is going to take that video and do something dramatic with it? So it really is hard to tell what the result of your efforts is ultimately going to be. So keep up, those of you who are working this and are doing this, keep up the good work. I really appreciate it. And keep creating videos. And we will do a lot of that as well at the Institute. We will do more of that now that we've got a proof of concept, in a sense, of what works. Now, of course, you can then try 1,000 other ones that look exactly the same and they don't go viral. So what makes something go viral? I think generally what makes something go viral is me getting really pissed off. So if you find videos of me fairly pissed off, really getting angry and really being passionate, that seems to really ignite a lot of interest and a lot of people watching. So maybe that's the secret. Look for those videos and see if you can, you can make one of those work for you. All right. Hong Kong. So I've been in Hong Kong a couple of days. I gave 2 talks, one at Hong Kong University to some students, although quite a few adults showed up, about 40, 45 students. And then yesterday I gave a talk for Lion Rock Institute, which is a free market institute here in Hong Kong that, promotes free markets, but very much from a practical perspective, from a policy perspective, from an economics government perspective, explicitly not philosophical. So there's Eric. Eric just joined the chat, at least. And Eric is the guy who created that video that then was turned into, right? I think that's the same Eric. Eric, is that you? So thank you. Anyway, I gave a talk last night to a group of businessmen, so supporters of members of Lion Rock Institute, about 40 of them. at a very, very nice event in Hong Kong. And so this is a story. So Hong Kong, as I said, 75 years ago, it was a fishing village. There was not much there. And today, 7.5 million people, GDP per capita on a purchasing power parity, which is the right way to look at GDP per capita, is basically people here richer than Americans on average. You've got a number of billionaires here. You've got a lot of very wealthy people. You do have some poor people here. There's no question. So a lot of people in Hong Kong are concerned about, well, let me see. I've got a sound effect. Concerned about? Concerned about inequality. Oh, too much drum roll. All right. So they're concerned that did not work out well. They're concerned about inequality. They're really concerned. So that becomes a big issue. Both of my talks were about inequality, and so it's a big issue. So like I did two interviews, and the interviews were about inequality. Everybody wants to talk about inequality. Everybody's concerned about inequality. Inequality is the issue. It's amazing to me. Here's this unbelievable successful place. Here's the place where people came to who were dirt poor. People came to from rural China. People came to from all over Asia and have been incredibly successful. Yes, they're relatively poor, but they're relatively rich as compared to where they came from. It goes back to that video I did about Chinese sweatshops. People have chosen to come here because this is a better option of what they have elsewhere. And what people who complain about inequality want to do is deny them that ability, deny them the ability to improve their own lives. So Hong Kong is a place of vast inequality, a high Gini coefficient, for those of you who know what that means. And people are complaining about it. People want the government to do something about it. And the government over the last 10 years has got more involved in the economy. There's more regulations. There's more financial regulation. There's an equivalent of the SEC here that regulates things like the stock market and financial trading and hedge funds and things like that. And basically, from what I understand, as incompetent as the SEC is in the United States. So you're getting more and more and more government intervention in the Hong Kong economy, which is just striking and depressing, because how unbelievable and unequivocally a success story Hong Kong has become because of capitalism and free markets. And why? So why is Hong Kong, just like to some extent Chile and just like the United States and just like pretty any country that experienced success under capitalism, why is it reversing course? Why is it starting to reverse course? Why is government getting more involved? Now, partially it's pressure from China, but it's not just pressure from China. It's not just pressure from China. What else is causing this to happen? Well, it turns out from my discussion with businessmen yesterday at the event, that just like in Chile, just like in the United States, just like everywhere else, it is the people who have been successful. It is the successful individuals in the culture in Hong Kong who feel guilty about their success and who therefore cave to any pressure to regulate them, to redistribute their wealth, to increase taxes, to grow the role of government. It is not pressure from the poor. It is not pressure from the so-called needy that drives this. But it is the guilt felt by the successful that is driving it. This is the same as in California, the same as in Chile, the same as in country after country after country. It is the moral argument. It is the fact that people who are successful feel, and here's a word I want to talk about today, a word that pisses me off. Yuan's going to get angry now. I heard it yesterday, and I went after the guy who said it. 60-year-old guy. And so guess what word really ticks me off? There's one word that everybody uses now that is used on American campuses everywhere. Everywhere now that I go around the world, they use this. Everywhere, every time it's used, I basically go after the person who used it and try to strangle them. I mean, rhetorically, of course, not physically. I would never initiate force against another human being for the ideas that they have. No, it's not fairness. It's not fairness. It's not safe spaces. You know, businessmen don't talk about safe spaces. And for that matter, businessmen don't talk about fairness that much. No, it's something. Think about a successful businessman, or think about a white college kid from a middle class or upper middle class or wealthy family. What do they consider themselves these days? So what is the word that describes? No, it's not giving back. It's not giving back. That's too easy. It's not luck, but it's related. It's not. It's much worse than luck. It's much worse than giving back. It's a word that you hear all the time on American campuses. It's a word associated with, yes, Jeremy, got it. All right. Privileged. It drives me nuts. Now, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to look up in the dictionary, because maybe I'm overreacting, right? What does privileged actually mean, right? So here's what privilege means, right? This is, I just Googled it, and this is what came out. I don't know what dictionary this is, but this is what came out, and this is what drives me nuts, right? And I'll go to the Cambridge English Dictionary in a minute, because that's there as well. Privilege means, I hear it everywhere. I heard it yesterday. We privileged wealthy in Hong Kong. We need to do something to help, blah, 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 blah. We, you know, white privilege is huge in American campuses. We white people who have privilege have to do X, Y, Z, and they have to do, as always, we have to sacrifice. Everywhere I go, people are talking about privileged. This is the victory of the left. They have won. They have made everybody who is successful and who is accidentally white feel guilty. It is unbelievable to me. This has to be fought. This has to be argued against. This has to be, you know, eliminated from our vocabulary. Somebody could actually edit this whole discussion of privilege and put it up like on YouTube and something. That would be cool. Anyway, what does privilege mean? It means having special rights, having special advantages or immunities. It means, now this is in the dictionary, this is me, it means being an aristocrat. Aristocrats are privileged. Why? Because they're not equal before the law. They have special treatments. They have special rights. They have special privileges. Second definition of privileged, legally protected. Right? Or let's check this out. Let's look at the Cambridge here. An advantage that only one person or group of people has, usually because of their position or because they are rich. An opportunity to do something special that is not enjoyed by others, obviously. Because then the third definition in the Cambridge definition, the way in which rich people or people from a high society class have the most advantage in society. Now, again, see how they mix class, social class, which used to mean an aristocracy and special rights, special privileges from the crown, with being rich. And that's exactly the association the left wants us to make. It wants us to associate wealth with aristocracy. It wants us to associate wealth with special rights. So you became wealthy not because of hard work. You became wealthy not because you created value. You became wealthy not because of your particular talents. You became wealthy not because of something extraordinary about you, not because of the effort, energy, thought, focus that you put into the job. You became wealthy because you have some kind of privilege. And once you're wealthy, you sustain your wealth and you give your wealth to your kids, and that creates some kind of privilege, which means you're getting it. It's the idea that wealth and cronyism go together. Wealth and aristocracy go together. You cannot become wealthy unless you have ties to the government, unless you're getting special rights, unless there's something special granted to you that other people do not have. It is a disgusting term. It's a disgusting term. You're not privileged by being wealthy. You don't have any special rights by being wealthy. Rights, the whole point of economic, of political liberty, of political freedom, of the Declaration of Independence, is the idea that we are equal before the law, that we do not grant privilege to the aristocrats. We do not have special classes. Indeed, we do not have classes in America. You make money, not take money. What's the difference between an aristocrat and a rich person under capitalism? An aristocrat is a good thief. An aristocrat stole his wealth, exploited people in the feudal system, robbed them on the highways. That's what robber barons really were originally. Right? Robber barons were robbers who, in Europe, who placed tolls on the roads going through their territory and stole money from people who traveled through. That was the original concept of robber barons. But then we associate with capitalists who don't rob, but who create, who make. And those creators and makers are now privileged. They've got special rights, special favors from the government. Now, yeah, it's related to the issue of luck. It's related to the idea that you didn't actually earn it, that you didn't build it. It's all an attack on wealth. The whole idea of you didn't build it, the whole idea of it's luck, the whole idea of society made it possible for you, the whole idea that your kindergarten teacher made you and you wouldn't be anything without your kindergarten teacher. By the way, if you had a great kindergarten teacher, if you had a great teacher generally, it would be nice if once you grow up and you've been a successful person, go thank them. And if you're really, really rich, write them a check. That would be an act of justice. But that has nothing to do with denying the fact that you're responsible for your own success. Lots of people had good teachers and did nothing with that fact. So, yeah, somebody mentioned the privilege. Now, the funny thing was that yesterday I lashed out at this guy, right? You shouldn't talk about privilege. You made your wealth. And then he comes back to me and he says, no, you see, I didn't actually make my wealth. I inherited it, and I come from an aristocratic family in England. So he was actually, in some sense, privileged. But I said to him, and I believe this to be true, if you're still wealthy, it means that you have lived up to your wealth. It means that you're deserving of that wealth. It means you haven't squandered it, you haven't blown it, you haven't thrown it away. And if I still don't think you're privileged, because in Hong Kong there is no privilege. Cronyism is relatively, it's still bad here, relatively trivial. So you can assume somebody's wealthy in Hong Kong. It's not because of cronyism, which I would consider privilege. It's because of what you do with it. And the same with this white privilege. You're born white, and therefore you have special rights, and therefore you're destined to be successful. Has anybody traveled in the Appalachian Mountains and met white trash? Or gone to, you know, everywhere, not just in Appalachians, but I don't want to pick on the Appalachians, but everywhere you go, you meet white trash. People who are white, privileged, but who have done nothing with their lives. Zero, zilch, nothing. It has nothing to do with there are trashy people everywhere. Trashy people of every race, trashy people of every ethnic background, trashy people of every cultural background. Because they make bad choices, it has nothing to do with their skin color. It has nothing to do with the culture they grew up in. It has everything to do with the choices they make. So we are not products of luck. We are products of our own thinking. We're products of our own choices. We're products of our free will. We're products of whether we choose to focus, whether we choose to engage our reason or not. People who are trashy are typically people who have chosen to drift, chosen to live off of others, chosen to be parasites. That's what crooks are, that's what thieves are, that's what cheats are, and that's what people who just laze around and do nothing and who receive welfare and don't work properly for a living. There's nothing to do with being white. There's nothing to do with where you were born. Now, it's true. It's easier if you're born in America to become successful. It's more difficult if you're born in, I don't know, Myanmar, or Cambodia to become successful. One reason that I believe immigration should be easier is that the people who are born in Cambodia and Myanmar, who are ambitious, who want to be successful, and who want a real shot in life, and who want to think, and at whatever level they are capable of, I want them to have an opportunity to come to Hong Kong, to come to America, to come to somewhere so they can be successful in life. I think it's a travesty of justice to build walls to prevent them from coming. Now, granted, do away with welfare, so you're more secure in the fact that the people are coming are really coming because they're ambitious, because they want to make a successful life for themselves. But let's fight welfare. Let's not deny people entry. That should be the key. So this whole idea of privilege just drives me nuts. Came up yesterday. But the fact that people would talk about it in Hong Kong, and people talk about it in Hong Kong. Hong Kong, the most self-made place on the planet, more so than the United States. The fewer natural resources, shorter time to becoming rich. Just stunning, stunning, stunning place. No advantages, no privileges other than freedom. Now, freedom is not a privilege. Freedom, my friends, is a right. Freedom, my friends, is a right. So, you know, these are the kind of ideas that are destroying the world. The inequality, you've heard me talk about inequality many times. I'm not going to repeat it too much here. The idea of privilege, the idea of luck. But this is the way, it's fascinating to me. It's not socialism that's winning. It's not Democrats that are willing politically. Indeed, the Democrats are losing. It's not a political agenda that's winning. It's not a political agenda anywhere in the world that is our enemy, really. Our enemy is an epistemological agenda. Our enemy is a moral agenda. Our enemy is the loose way in which words are used, in which concepts are used to undercut freedom and capitalism and prosperity. And that's epistemological. And that's philosophical. And it's consciously done by the left. The left are not primarily political. They have political aims. They have political goals. But their tools are philosophical. Their tools are psychological. I mean, part of what privilege does is it undercuts, and the purpose of it is to undercut the self-esteem of successful people. It's to undercut the self-esteem of the wealthy. It's to undercut the self-esteem of the capitalists, so that they don't stand up for themselves, so that they're confronted with the enemy, they fold. So, you know, this is kind of a side note, but I think a fascinating one. So I was reading an essay by Ayn Rand, Altruism as Appeasement as Altruism. I think it's Appeasement as Altruism in, I think it's The Voice of Reason. And wow, it's a hard essay to understand. I struggled. I was reading it the other day, and I was like, what does she mean? What does this actually mean? What does this imply? How does this work? What's the logic here? I was really struggling. And I realized something about Ayn Rand's writing, which I don't think people realize, and I don't think people think enough about, and I don't think people appreciate enough. A lot of what Ayn Rand wrote was psychological. A lot of Ayn Rand's observations about culture and about the world and about altruism and about the way in which altruism plays out or collectivism plays out or is about how it affects people's psychology. And she talks about the bad guys primarily in psychological terms. And it's something we objectivists don't do enough of. And I don't think most objectivists understand psychology or have any kind of orientation towards thinking about psychology. We're very good at logic. We're very good at facts. We're very good at understanding kind of deduction and maybe to some extent induction. But we have very little understanding of psychology. And I think part of the reason for that is, well, we don't have enough psychologists and objectivists who talk about these things. We have a few, but we don't have enough. But also, the philosophers who talk about philosophy tend not to talk about psychology as much as Ayn Rand did. Leonard Peikoff talks about this somewhat, but nowhere near enough. So the psychological impacts of altruism are fascinating, and what it does to the human mind and what it implies about how people behave and how people react. And I encourage you all to read Ayn Rand's article on altruism and appeasement. And I have to read it a couple more times before I feel comfortable to talk about it, because I really found it hard. And it is this psychological perspective that she has. And she shifts between philosophy and psychology seamlessly and naturally. And to her, it's completely logical. And to me, it's not my orientation, right? I'm a finance guy, right? I'm an engineer, and I do some philosophy. So I come at everything from a logical engineering kind of perspective. Ayn Rand doesn't. Ayn Rand's a novelist. Just think what it takes. So see, here's a point. I think I heard Ankar Gade talk about this first time. So this is certainly as much of what I say. A lot of what I say is not original, but this I think I got from Ankar. Or maybe it's, and I think Leonard talks about this as well. Ayn Rand was first and foremost a novelist. Now, what does a novelist have to do in order to be a successful novelist? To be a successful novelist, one must create characters that are real, characters that are human beings, characters with a psychology. Think about Reardon in Atlas Shrugged. Think about how he's torn. Think about how guilt-ridden he is in the beginning of the novel. Think about how it changes. I mean, one of the things that really the critics of Ayn Rand really gets to me is when they say that Ayn Rand's characters are cardboard characters, when nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, to some extent, one could argue that Galt is a cardboard character, because Galt in the novel, we don't get a psychological perspective on Galt. We don't get any kind of understanding on Galt. You observe his actions from the outside. We have speeches that he makes, but we don't know John Galt. We know Dagny Taggart. We know Reardon. We don't know Galt. And that's part of what Ayn Rand does on purpose. I mean, she's not giving us purposefully, I think, a kind of a history and a psychology. We don't know John Galt's history. We know very little about John Galt. We know a lot about Dagny. We know a lot about Reardon. But think about what it takes to be a good novelist. It means understanding human psychology. It means understanding the implication, psychological implication, of holding particular philosophical points of view. So Reardon's view of sex, Reardon's view of family, Reardon's view of his work, Reardon's view of his society around him, which are to a large extent psychological responses, are shaped by deep philosophical premises, in this case altruism, and his implicit belief in it and his implicit acceptance of it. And the consequences, the psychological consequences, not philosophical consequences. There are philosophical consequences, and you see that on how the whole culture changes. But the beauty of Ayn Rand's writing, the interesting thing about Ayn Rand's writing, is the psychological consequences of these evil ideas. The psychological consequences of Reardon, who then, as he discovers, as he learns the explicit alternative philosophy to the altruism that he has implicitly accepted, his psychology changes, his emotions change, and he changes throughout, right? Or take Dominique. Well, talk about psychology. Take Dominique in The Fountainhead. I mean, I struggle to understand her every time I read the book, right? She's hard. But again, she's accepted certain false premises. She's accepted certain false ideas. Now, how does that manifest itself in her character? How does that manifest itself in her actions? How does that manifest itself in her emotions? That is fascinating. That is so interesting. And it's so revealing about Ayn Rand and her writing and her knowledge and understanding of psychology, which I think is vastly underestimated. And I think it's, you know, just speculation. It's why I think she was so attracted to Brandon, because Brandon was Nathaniel Brandon, because he was a psychologist, right? And I think she had deep thoughts about psychology and had a real understanding of psychology and a real understanding of character and real understanding of emotion and how ideas manifest themselves in a psychological attitudes. So her writing is so filled with a psychological view of man, a psychological view of what bad ideas do to a human being. And I think that's what makes her essays. I always read her essays and say, nobody in objectivism writes like that. I don't write like that. Don, Alex, I mean, nobody. None of our philosophers really write like Ayn Rand. And if you look at how deep their essays are, interesting their essays are, how complex their essays are, and partially it's a philosophical genius. But I don't think it's just that. I also think it's a psychological insight that she has into behavior, into the behavior of politicians, the behavior of political leaders, the behavior of wealthy businessmen, the behavior of people around us. It really is fascinating, right? It really is fascinating. Now, you know, and you see it in an, and it's because she's an, I think it's because she's a novelist, right? She cannot portray the ideal man without having a deep understanding of human psychology, right? And you know, what she's doing in Galt, I'm not saying Galt is superficial or cardboard character. I understand why people think that. I don't understand why people can think that of Rita or Dagny, who are deeply, you know, who really go deeply into their soul and really see them, you know, see Dagny's response to music, see Dagny's bewilderment at what's going on in the world, see Dagny's confusion and conflict with Galt. You see all that. Galt is far, far from a cardboard character. This is what happens when somebody, what is it, a face with no sign of guilt. This is what happens. This is the kind of character, this is the kind of human being you get when there is no psychological conflict. There are no bad premises. There are no bad ideas. You get the full integration, and that's what Galt represents. Galt represents a full integration of the philosophy. But the sense in which that full integration has been with him since he was very, very young. So this isn't something where he changes. Whereas even Francisco has this tinge of regret at the strike, right? Without giving it away too much, right? Galt never has even that tinge, right? And Francisco, of course, comes as close to a fleshed out where you have a history, where you have a childhood, where you have all this stuff as you get, because Francisco is, except for that tinge of doubt that happens momentarily at one point, he's perfect. So the book Atlas Shrugged is so rich with characterization, so rich with characters, right? So rich with everything, with changes, with psychology, with emotion, with understanding of human beings. And then what Ayn Rand does is after finishing writing novels and starting writing nonfiction, is she brings that same deep understanding and perspective of human psychology to her nonfiction writing. And that, I think, is what makes it so unique, so interesting, so fascinating, and so hard to grasp for somebody like me, who is not, you know, really that deep when it comes to psychological. Now, you know, it's also the philosophy, which is still hard for me, right? I'm not a philosopher, and it makes it hard for me. But there's this real depth and interesting perspective that she has that I think a lot of people scratch their heads and don't understand, because it's not that altruism means living for other people, so therefore people live for other people. And that's the behavior we see. And then we look around the world, and I think this is what superficially people read Ayn Rand and say, but wait a minute. People don't live for other people. People are out there pursuing their careers. They have families. They love their families. They do well in their careers. They seemingly are happy and all this other stuff. And what they miss is the fact that, yes, that what altruism does to them is not that they become slaves to other people. It's and indeed, at the end of the day, the purpose of altruism is not for you to benefit other people. It's what it does to the people psychologically. The guilt that it creates. It's a lack of self-esteem that results from the fact that you have altruistic premises. It's the fact that you tolerate your family more than you should. It's the fact that you let people like Rita's brother hang around you and support them in a way that you shouldn't be doing it. It's the eating away at your soul. It's eating away at your self-esteem. It's eating away at your confidence. It's the guilt. It's your willingness to accept things that a person of self-esteem would never, ever, ever accept. It's the appeasement. That is what altruism really does to you. It turns you into an appeaser, an appeaser of your own life. At least that's what I took from the wrestling. I think it's absolutely right. And again, you're seeing it in Hong Kong. What is happening is the philosophy, the altruism, the guilt is turning businessmen in Hong Kong. The heart of what Hong Kong is, the heart of what made Hong Kong, the heart of what sustains its freedom and has sustained its freedom, it's turning them weak. It's turning them into appeasers. So when they'll go to mainland China and they get lectured by the Communist Party official about how China needs to become more socialist, in a, Hong Kong needs to become more socialist in a sense, they go into the meeting, oh no, we're capitalists, we believe in freedom, we become rich, we've been successful because of this. And they walk out of the meeting having sold their soul because they can't stand for themselves. So it's not that they are not working for their own well-being and daily on a daily basis going out there and working in food in soup kitchens. That's not what altruism primarily does to you. What primarily does to you is that you believe that you should be at the soup kitchen. And because you're not at the soup kitchen, you feel guilty about it. So that's the real evil impact, the real evil influence that altruism has on human being and that altruism is having in Hong Kong. Now, this is a real problem because as America is to the West, as America is a symbol of everything that is good in the West, and as America is a symbol of what is possible in the West, as America is in many respects the future of the West, Europe I don't think can survive philosophically, ideologically, and economically without the United States. As the United States becomes more like Europe, we're all lost. We're all lost. So I think Hong Kong serves that purpose in Asia. Hong Kong is the beacon of freedom. Hong Kong is the beacon of capitalism. It is the beacon of success. It's the beacon of rights, even though individual rights have never been explicitly protected here. They have been implicitly protected. This is what made this country great. And in that sense, it's not about political freedom or economic freedom or any other kind of freedom you want. It's about individual rights, which are individual freedom. And as long as you protect individual rights, the exact mechanism by which you do your politics is less important. Now, I don't believe in a benevolent dictator because I don't believe benevolent dictators ultimately exist because I think that kind of power corrupts. But I believe in a limited government, in a government that does very little. So voting for it becomes very unimportant. So I think voting generally is an unimportant thing. It's not a primary right. It's not that important. What is important is the protection of individual rights, and to the extent that Hong Kong government has protected individual rights by default, by accepting kind of a British system, but it doesn't have democracy and it's never had voting, you know, that beats the alternative. Because I can guarantee you that if Hong Kong had democracy, if they voted for everything, if they had majority rule, they would violate individual rights. So the primary is rights. The primary is protection of rights. But anyway, Hong Kong is the beacon for Asia. And if it's the beacon of Asia over the last 10 years, and this is what I'm told, guilt has increased. Confidence in capitalism has decreased. Confidence in pride in their wealth has decreased. And they have more and more and more accepted kind of the guilt, the altruism that's associated with it. And therefore, politically, they have more and more accepted the idea of a regulatory and redistributive state. Then where does Asia go? What example is China going to emulate? I mean, my hope in 1997, when China took over Hong Kong, was that at the end of the day, it would be Hong Kong that takes over China. And to some extent, that's already happened. But only to some extent. There's still a lot of work to do in China to make it be like Hong Kong. A lot of freedom needs to be protected in China before it becomes like Hong Kong. Primarily, the protection of property rights needs to be instituted in China. So, if Hong Kong loses that spirit, loses the ideas, then where does China go? And if China has no place to go, where does the world go? If Europe and the United States are heading in the wrong direction, and China, while heading in the right direction, is probably going to have to reverse course because it won't have a model to emulate. It won't have the United States, and soon it won't have Hong Kong. Where does the world go? So I'm depressed again. It's so easy to be pessimistic as you travel around the world. On the one hand, it's inspiring to see Seoul and to see Korea in 60 years go from one of the poorest countries in the world, maybe the poorest country in the world, poorer than North Korea, by the way, to one of the richest countries in the world, to come to Hong Kong and to see what they've achieved in 75 years and to see the vibrancy and the energy, and to go to China and to see what China's achieved in less than 75 years and what its potential still is there. And you see that entrepreneurial, that individualistic, that drive, that spirit that people have. And yet at the same time to realize that the ideas that are winning, the ideas that are dominating the world, the ideas that are in the universities here in Hong Kong, just like any other universities, are ideas that are so, so, so destructive. There are ideas that are going to destroy the fabulous spirit of the Chinese people, that are going to destroy the amazing progress and the energy and the excitement and the self-esteem and the confidence of the people in Hong Kong. Our universities are filled with people aiming to crush the cranes, to crush the wealth, to crush the spirit, to crush the self-esteem and confidence. And they're not being challenged by almost anybody. They're not being challenged by almost anybody. And if you want to understand the role of Ayn Rand, I believe, and I really believe this. This is not an act. This is not because it's my job. This is not anything else. I believe this since I read Ayn Rand for the first time. But certainly I have a much, much deeper, much better, much wider, much more substantial appreciation of that fact today than I did back then. That Ayn Rand is it. If we are going to save the world, it is Ayn Rand's ideas that are going to have to do it. It is Ayn Rand's ideas that are going to have to challenge the prevailing philosophy that's out there. There's nobody else. It's not going to be Hayek. It's not going to be von Mises. It's not going to be Hume, or, you know, skeptic. It's not going to be, I don't know, fill in the blank. There's nobody else. Ayn Rand is the only one who has a metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, and political politics that are pro-man, pro-freedom, pro-capitalism. It's not going to be Milton Friedman. I mean, they've had their time. They won the battle in economics, Friedman, Hayek, Mises. They're the best economists ever. They won it. It's done. It's over. There is no economic argument for socialism. The argument for socialism is philosophical and psychological and epistemology all the way. People can't think. This is why they use stupid words like privilege. Now, that's moral and epistemological. It's a combination. This is why they obsess about inequality, moral and epistemological, all of these issues. You can't talk about morality without talking about epistemology. You can't talk about epistemology without talking about morality in the context of life. So here we are. And this is why I implore you guys to keep on fighting. Fighting philosophically, fighting for Ayn Rand. We're a tiny, 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 tiny minority of people who get it, who get the importance of philosophy, and who get the importance of the only philosophy that can save Western civilization, the only philosophy that can bring us back to the Enlightenment, that can bring us back to the ideas of the Enlightenment, what the Enlightenment actually meant. And America needs it, and Europe needs it, and hell, Asia needs it. So last night, I implored people to think about ways in which the Ayn Rand Institute can get more involved in Hong Kong. So just like the U.S. is the beacon for the Western world, Hong Kong is the beacon for Asia. If we're going to influence China, if we're going to influence the rest of Asia, which is a relatively young population and a relatively ambitious and growing and dynamic and exciting place, then we have to have a presence here in Hong Kong. We have to change the direction in which Hong Kong is going. I am no longer U.S.-centric. I am no longer focused exclusively in the U.S. We've got to be in the U.S. We've got to be in key places, particularly in Eastern Europe, and we've got to be in Hong Kong. To me, those are the three centers of gravity. Those are the three places in which we have to have a presence, in which we have to fight. By the way, somebody on the chat is saying that Austin, Texas has no zoning. That is not true. Austin is heavily, heavily zoned. Austin, Texas is heavily zoned. The city that has no zoning is Houston. So just a correction, although I've been told I shouldn't be distracted by the chat. You guys are talking off topic and it's distracting. So I expect to do more in Hong Kong. I expect to figure out how to bring Ayn Rand's philosophy more aggressively to Hong Kong. I think we have an impact on young people here. Young people here are lefty. They want democracy in a sense of absolute democracy. Right? They bought into the BS that they're getting from the U.S. universities. We have to be here in educational institutions. There's an opportunity to get into the high schools in Hong Kong. But also, we've got to get to the business community here. We've got to give them the tools to get a backbone, to grow a backbone, to get rid of this guilt. Now, it might be too late. It might be too late. I hope not. So, my ambition is to really have a focus in the U.S., obviously, everything we do, to develop ourselves in Europe and to grow in Europe and to grow in Hong Kong and to bridge all this by using the web, by using the internet, by using a dynamic, exciting website and social media. And this goes back to the videos that I encouraged you all to create, to make, to distribute, to share. The most important thing you can do, by the way, in social media, some consultant told me this, is not to like. Liking is, it's nice, but it ain't significant. The most important thing, and the thing that the algorithms of both Twitter and Facebook value the most, and the thing that creates buzz and creates an impact, is to share, which means retweets in Twitter, means sharing in Facebook, means sharing in LinkedIn, means sharing in Instagram or whatever social media you use. Share, 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 share. Right? Share, 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 share. So, by the way, just on the Austin thing, Austin is a very leftist place. It's a very leftist city. It's got massive environmental regulations that restrict building and restrict development. It's heavily, heavily zoned because it's the capital of Texas. It's controlled by government, and it has a massive university, so it's dominantly left. And in that sense, it's terrible. Now, it's also a beautiful city, and I love Austin. But the city, if you want a city that's not zoned, it's Houston. They've had a number of attempts to pass city ordinances to start zoning, and those have been defeated over and over time. So please share from everywhere, from my page, from anywhere you want. Sharing is the most important thing you can do. And social media is a fantastic way in which to get the word out. And we're going to be investing quite a bit more of effort and some money, and I'm hoping to raise some money around this, in social media at the Institute so that we could get better at creating viral videos, get better at creating stuff that people will share, get better at getting the word out there through the beauty of social media, right? So please help us make that happen. All right, I promised to discuss a couple of other topics, so let me get to them quickly. Oh my God, do I really want to talk about Donald Trump? Spare me. Talk about psychology. Oh my God, what Ayn Rand would have a field day with this guy. A field day. She actually had interesting psychological things to say about people. Can you imagine what she would say about Donald Trump? I can't. I think Trump would have even exacerbated Ayn Rand just unbelievable. Unbelievable. Right? There's no way Ayn Rand would ignore Donald Trump. He's way, way, way too psychologically interesting. There's no way she would ignore him. And dangerous. I mean, really, really, really dangerous. Right? So I wish we could see Ayn Rand on Donald Trump. I really wish she was here to tell us, because it would be fascinating, it would be new, it would be different. And as much as I try to use her philosophy to explain Donald Trump, she would be so much better at it. But there's no way she would ignore Donald Trump. He's too dangerous. He's got the codes. I just read this. Do you know that he is going to Saudi Arabia next week? He's visiting Israel. So I know that because I was supposed to do a debate in Jerusalem on Monday, right, at a university. Now, I was supposed to bait this university professor on the issue of on the issue of inequality, a leftist university professor. And it turns out Donald Trump is going to be in Jerusalem the same time I'm scheduled to be in Jerusalem, and all the streets are going to be shut down. All the roads are going to be blocked. There's no way I'm going to get there. There's no way an audience. So we rescheduled the debate for Tel Aviv. We're going to do it in a bar. Don't ask me. I have no idea why in a bar. I don't know how it's going to work. I don't know how it's going to happen. I've given a talk at a bar in Jerusalem, so in Tel Aviv, so it might be the same bar. I don't know. It's not going to be very good. It's not going to be as good as in a classroom. But there you go. It is what it is. So Donald Trump's going to be in Israel. But did you know that after that, Donald Trump is going to Saudi Arabia? And so one of the things to watch is, will he bow to the prince, right? You remember they made a big deal out of Obama doing it. I bet you that if Donald Trump does it, it'll be a sign of respect. When Obama does it, everybody went nuts about how he's basically groveling before the prince of Saudi Arabia or the king of Saudi Arabia. But you know what he's going to do in Saudi Arabia? He's going to give a major speech on Islam in Saudi Arabia. Now, this is one to watch, right? He said some pretty bad things about Islam in the past, but could he do that in Saudi Arabia, really? Even Donald Trump wouldn't do that, right? So this is going to be interesting to watch. Why is he going to Saudi Arabia to begin with? The enemy is going to Israel and Saudi Arabia. Oh, he's going to Saudi Arabia before Israel. Interesting. And he's going to give a speech on Islam. So this is one I want the transcript for. Next show, we'll talk about the transcript of the speech Donald Trump gave on Islam in Saudi Arabia in front of the king of Saudi Arabia, and the royal family, probably the number one funders of terrorism, maybe number two after Iran, in the world. Right. Oh, my God. So I haven't commented on all the problems Trump's having with the Russia investigation for two reasons. One, because I don't know what to say, right? I mean, the guy shoots himself in the foot every day. He's so pathetic. He is so incompetent. Now, you can blame the press. You can blame the media. And I know a lot of you do, right? A lot of you Trump fans. Everything's the media fault. They're after him. It's a witch hunt, whatever. But you've got to admit that this guy plays into their hand constantly, constantly. He can't keep his mouth shut. He can't keep his mouth shut in meetings with the Russians. He can't keep his mouth shut on Twitter. He writes a stupid resignation. He writes a stupid letter firing Comey. I don't know if you read that letter, but it's ridiculous. It's stupid. Who is advising this guy? Somebody is editing him? The letter basically, he's admitting that he's firing him because of this investigation, which is an obstruction of justice, which he doesn't want to admit to. But he can't help himself because he's a CEO. And a CEO just said, you're fired. And you're fired because you're undercutting me. You can't do that in politics, but you can do that in a business. And he can't help himself. He just can't help himself. All right. So it's just. I mean, what do you do here? I mean, you want me to compare him to Obama? Obama was respectable as compared to Trump. I mean, I'm sorry. Obama at least understood what it meant to be president. He didn't undercut the very notion of the presidency every single day. But think about how disrespectful the staff at the White House must be towards Trump when everything he does is leaked. It's leaking more than the Obama White House did. And there was a lot of leaks out of Obama. I don't know. It's just pathetic. Now, Obama was the ideologically worse in the sense that Obama was the first and only, in my view, anti-American, explicitly anti-American president. Trump, I think, is not the first, but he is the most anti-ideological president, anti-thinking president, anti-having a clue president. He just doesn't have a clue. He doesn't understand politics. He doesn't know how to do politics. He doesn't understand what it means to be president of the United States. He doesn't know how to keep his mouth shut. He has no manners. He has no decency. He's just a bad human being. Yeah, I know. So I'm again being accused of listening to the media too much. Look, I watched Donald Trump during the debates. I thought he was pathetic and a horrible human being during the debate. You remember what he said about Carly Fiorina? The media didn't make that up. I remember when Donald Trump defended Putin killing journalists. I saw it with my own eyes. He said it on television. The media didn't make that up. Give me a break. He tweets. I read his tweets. The media doesn't make that up. I mean, this is not a media conspiracy. Now, it could be that some of the details are made up by the media. Could, sure, but you expect that, right? The media goes after every Republican president, to some extent, they even go after Democrats. And remember the impeachment of Clinton? Remember what Republicans did because he got a blowjob in a closet in the White House, right? Tried to impeach him. That was important. That was substantial. That's what the Republicans were wasting their time on back then. So, yeah, that was a witch hunt as well. Who cares if the president gets a blowjob in the closet, right? When his ideas are so horrific, that's what you should be fighting. But don't tell me Donald Trump is not the brute that he makes himself out to be. Not that the media makes him out to be. It's not even an issue of disliking. It's an issue of objectively assessing the person's character based on his actions, based on what he says, not what the media says. Based on what he says, what he writes. I read the letter he wrote firing Comey. It was a pathetic, badly written, self-indicting letter that nobody who has an editor would ever let out. Nobody who has half a brain would ever let out. You know, Obama was worse ideologically, but it was not worse in how he behaves. Sorry, he wasn't. I would much rather have a beer with Obama than with Trump. I know. Now I'm gonna be slaughtered out there. That's it. It's the end. I wouldn't want to have a beer with either one of them. Let's be clear. And I certainly wouldn't want to have a beer with Hillary Clinton. I despise the woman. I despise them all. But that doesn't mean we can't be objective about Trump. Trump is to be despised. Yeah, is death an option? I like that. Somebody says, is death an option? You have to have beer with Hillary, Obama, or Trump. What do you choose? I choose not drinking, period. Fasting for the day. I don't know if I choose death, but I'm willing to forego food and drink for a while just not to have that experience. I mean, look, the guy's a terrible president so far. He didn't fight, you know, we got Obamacare Lite, which is the only real thing that's come out. And of course, the Senate hasn't finished with it. So who knows what will happen there. Yeah, I know Facebook, all those thousands of people who added me on Facebook, I just lost them. I should just stay away from talking about Trump. I don't know. I you know, and I've tried for weeks now. I haven't said much about Trump. But you know, Congress is people are talking about possibly impeaching him. You know, he's coming to Israel, interfering with my plans, and he's going to Saudi Arabia and he's going to give a speech about Islam. How can I stay quiet? How can I stay quiet? So I am really looking forward to the speech about Islam because it'll be really indicative of. I mean, who knows what this will be? But in terms of his personality, it's not even about being intellectual. It's about thinking he's the CEO of America, which Obama didn't, because Obama has no clue what a CEO would even do. I don't want a CEO. The job of the president is not to be my CEO. The job of the president is to be my servant. Donald Trump has exactly the opposite perspective. He has the old JFK perspective. Ask not what the government can do, the country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. No, I don't do I don't do anything for my country. I want the country to serve. I want the government to serve me. I want the government to protect me. That's all I want for my government. I don't want a CEO running my life. I want a CEO running the police. I want a CEO running the military. I want a CEO running the judiciary who can do an effective, productive, efficient job. I want a CEO who can sell the idea of freedom and liberty and deregulation and lower taxes to American people. I haven't seen Donald Trump try any of that. I haven't seen him go on television and make a speech to American people about the importance of tax cutting. I haven't seen him go on television and make a speech about the importance of private health care. What I did see, what I saw, not what the media reported, what I saw with my own two eyes and heard with my own ears, is Donald Trump telling us that the Australian system of health care, which is socialized medicine, is better than the American system. Even Obama didn't do that because he was afraid to do it. And let me tell you, when a Republican says that socialized medicine is better than private medicine, that is 1,000 times worse than when a Democrat says it, because that means it's the end. That means the right has capitulated completely. Somebody says that Trump will eventually dig his own grave. He's already doing it. Eventually. I think it's happening right now. Think about what he said about socialized medicine. Think about what he said about Australia. Forget his character. Forget everything else. That alone should disqualify him from being a Republican president. Okay, if he's a Democratic president, remember, Obama and Hillary were Democrats. Obama and Hillary were Democrats. That's fine. Democrats are supposed to be socialists. But when we admire, respect, and vote for a Republican socialist, forget it, guys. Ah, okay. I'm calming down. I'm calming down. Ah, there's my sigh. All right, done, out of the way. So anyway, I think next show I might do it from Israel. If he actually gives this talk about Islam, I look forward to analyzing it. Hopefully it'll be a good talk. The Bannon wing of the White House supposedly is writing this talk, which makes it incredibly intriguing how they will get away with a talk like Bannon would give on Islam in Saudi Arabia. So it'll be interesting how they balance it out, how they attack, you know, fundamentalist Islamism. How about the Wahhabis? In the heart of fundamentalist Islam, of Islamism, of Wahhabism, of Islamic totalitarianism, which is Saudi Arabia, a country I've called the number two enemy of the United States after Iran. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting, right? So, anyway. I don't want, just to reiterate, we've got Bernie Sanders on the left. I don't need another one on the right. And indeed, there is no difference between left and right anymore. That's what's mind-boggling. They both believe in socialized medicine. At least the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party of the right believes in socialized medicine. And which means we've lost. We've lost. That's it. We've lost on healthcare. Back to the philosophical battle, which is where we need to fight. Okay, what else did I say I would talk about? So that was Trump. And we'll get back to it because I'm sure it's going to be in the news forever. Yeah, I want to talk about this Kansas effect. This is kind of interesting. It's in the news. And it'll be repeated over and over again because of the Trump's tax plan. So Kansas is an interesting case study. About 5-6 years ago, the governor of Brownback of Kansas managed to pass a bill through the Kansas legislature that basically dramatically cut taxes. Small businesses don't pay taxes at all, I think, and a dramatic cut in income taxes and a bunch of other taxes. And taxes will drop significantly, right? And as a consequence of cutting taxes dramatically, and as a consequence, which made a few reports about this, the decline in oil revenues, which are taxed, and agricultural revenues, which are taxed, revenues to the state of Kansas have dropped dramatically. And as a consequence, there's been massive deficits, cost to some significant, what people see as significant government services, and a general decline in what people believe is the standard of living, quality of life in Kansas, and now criticism from the left and from moderate Republicans and about tax cuts. And indeed, the Republican House and Senate in Kansas, just I think last week, passed massive tax increases, which then the government vetoed, and there weren't enough votes to override the veto, but it was close. Republicans raising taxes dramatically. in Kansas after they had cut them dramatically 5-6 years ago. Now, I've been saying this for a long, long time. Taxes are not what's important. Cutting taxes is not what's important. What's really important is spending. If you cut taxes and don't touch spending, and even spending, it's what you cut and how you cut it and being smart about it. Now, I don't know enough about the details in Kansas, but if you just cut taxes and you don't restructure the function of government, if you don't get government out of the lives of business, if you don't stop subsidizing, if you don't stop a lot of this other stuff, then what are you doing? All you're doing is setting yourself up for failure. This is what happened to Reagan. I mean, with, as much as we like Reagan, he cut taxes. He deregulated a little bit, but government spending doubled under the Reagan administration. So what happened to deficits? They exploded. In spite of the fact that he cut taxes and tax revenue went up, deficits exploded. So Bush, who followed Reagan, raised taxes. Clinton raised taxes again because the deficits were out of control. And deficits are bad. Not trade deficits, but budget deficits are bad because you have to borrow money to fill them. Borrow money means sucking money out of the private economy. It means the Chinese, with their dollars, are buying government debts instead of investing in American production. Imagine if China took the $1 trillion or so that it has, or maybe it's more than $1 trillion, bought in government U.S. government treasury securities and actually invested that $1 trillion in the U.S. economy, because that's what you do with dollars, right? Imagine how much that would increase productivity in the United States and actually enhance the private economy in the United States. Maybe the Chinese could buy a few of our airports and rebuild them like the Chinese airports here. I mean, the airports in China are gorgeous. Oh, there's no airport in the United States that comes close to the airport in Beijing or Shanghai or Hong Kong. Maybe that's what the Chinese should do with all their dollars. Instead of buying government debt, they should build our infrastructure. For that, we would have to privatize it, of course, but that's a good thing. As long as government is sucking money out of the private economy, whether through taxes or through debt, it is economically destructive. So the solution is to restructure government. It's to get government out of the business of these things, to sell government property, to reduce government's role in every aspect of the economy. Instead, what do? They cut education spending. Well, but without offering a solution, which is school choice or education saving accounts or a number of other things that you can do to transition towards private education instead of just shutting down public schools and alienating voters and upsetting people just to some extent, justifiably so. And then creating electoral pressure among voters to raise taxes again. So, this is the challenge with Republicans. All they know how to do is cut taxes. And in that sense, they do more damage than good because they play right into the Democrats' hands, and long-term, Republicans are a disaster. This is George W. Bush. Cut taxes. That's what he did. Cut taxes and go to war. And what was the consequence? Stupid wars, by the way. What are the consequences? The consequences were Obama. There would be no Obama if not for Bush. And who knows what the consequences of Trump is? Bernie Sanders or somebody much worse than Bernie Sanders? Because if Republicans keep doing stupid things, which, you know, after all, they are the stupid party, so I don't know what we can expect. If the Republicans keep doing stupid things, then we're going to get worse. They play right into the Democrats' hands. They play right into the hands of the worst of the Democrats, the worst of the worst. The real lefties. Obamacare converted into Trumpcare means failure of the insurance markets. Means what? It means socialized health care. And it'd be Republicans who'd bring it to us because they will be the ones who didn't reform health care properly and therefore created the disaster that will lead to socialized health care. Yeah, President Elizabeth Warren. Luckily, she's too old, I think. And she's too nasty to actually. You need an Obama-like person, somebody or somebody who can smile nicely, who can give a speech, who can, you know, can schmooze his way into it. I don't think Elizabeth Warren can actually do it. But, you know, a young Bernie Sanders. What's his name? Who used to be the mayor of New Jersey. Maybe he's the guy. It's scary. It's scary. So there's experiments at the states. Kansas cut taxes a lot. Has not clearly benefited from cutting the taxes. Now, granted, I'm oversimplifying it because as the governor says, a lot of the damage that was caused by the drop in oil prices and the drop in agricultural prices. But the deeper point is he didn't cut spending properly. He didn't restructure the government properly. He didn't actually reshape what government actually does, which is what is necessary. Necessary. And has to come first. If I were president, I would first restructure the government, first cut spending, and only then, after I did all the other things, cut regulations, cut, eliminate subsidies, eliminate the corporate tax, which I think is the first tax I would eliminate, go after all these other things, only then would I deal with the tax code in a significant way. But that's not Republicans. They because of altruism, going back to our theme for the last few shows, because of altruism, they can't cut spending. They can't stop regulation. They can't fire people significantly. So, we're stuck with these compromises. We're stuck with ever-growing government. We're stuck with these so-called experiments that actually fail and therefore have implications for the rest of us, even though it's an experiment in Kansas, all of us are going to suffer. So again, it's all about philosophy, guys, and it's required as a battle, and it requires a war, and it requires constant vigilance, and it requires constant talking about these things, and it requires constant reminders of the evil of altruism and collectivism and mysticism. And that's the other part of the Republican agenda. It's mystical and altruistic. You want me to vote for these guys? Yeah, I know. The alternative's worse. Oh, you don't have to convince me. Now, I'm gonna probably sign off a little early because I have to run for something. But let me know. Somebody on the chat mentioned that I didn't talk about Trump's meeting with Erdogan, which is related to the whole Islam thing. And I'm sorry I haven't, because I haven't had a chance to research it and to read, because I was traveling while it happened. So I'm sure it went badly. Because Erdogan is an Islamist. At the end of the day, he's an Islamist who believes in applying Sharia law, implementing Islam, spreading Islam more peacefully than does Al Qaeda or ISIS. He believes that you do it through demographics and the democratic process. A really, really bad guy. A really, really, really bad guy. So I'm sure I'd have a lot to say about his meeting with Trump and how Trump treated him and what Trump said. But Erdogan's a dictator and a thug and an Islamist. Ideologically, he is part of the enemy. He's part of enemy forces. And yet, Turkey's still a member of NATO, and so is the United States. So is the United States. Should it be? No more info. I'm going to keep you in suspense about the new show format starting in June 18th. I can tell you this, that there will probably be two different shows. One show focused which I take to be a more objectivist audience, an audience that's more insider, an audience that has read Ayn Rand, an audience that is more interested in philosophy than in public policy, that is interested in what's happening. So more shows like this. That are kind of insider shows that probably don't have an appeal to an outside audience. I mean, the show today probably doesn't have an appeal to an outside audience that it hasn't studied Ayn Rand and doesn't know when I throw away altruism or when I talk about the importance of philosophy or when I talk about my travels is probably less interested in that. And then a second show that will be targeted to the general public, that will be focused externally at the world. And will be carried by it will be on a network, on a well-known radio network. And we'll, you know, and some of you will be surprised, and some people might be upset by the choice of network, but it will be carried on a network starting June 18th. And I will, even though the contract's signed, there's still some details and some stuff that needs to be worked out. I will let you know more about that as we approach June 16th. We might have a launch, a Facebook Live launch party for it. So basically two shows. One like this on Blog Talk primarily, and one more outward facing, more like the AM560, but I think on a network that provides us with many more opportunities to reach a much larger audience than AM560 does. Anyway, that's the plan. That's what's going to happen starting June 18th. It's still a lot of stuff to work out, like how I'm going to do my travel schedule with all of this. You know, how I'm going to travel extensively as well. How, you know, lots of stuff to work out. But we're moving slowly, one step at a time, trying to increase the influence, trying to grow the platform, trying to get more viral videos. So a reminder for all of you to create viral videos, a reminder for all of you to study objectivism. You know, you guys are pretty committed, but there's a lot more to learn. There are new courses going up on campus every week now. There's Tara Smith's course that went up, which is excellent, that I encourage you to go and watch and listen to. And Harry Binswang on epistemology. I think four of the lessons have gone up. I think two more are coming, and you'll have the whole course. And then part two is going to be taped at OCON and then go up after OCON at some point. So we've got a lot of content. Listen to Leonard Peikoff on ARI campus, aynrand.org/campus. Tons and tons and tons of stuff. If you value Ayn Rand's ideas, if you want to make them part of your life, go and take the courses on campus, because that's where you really chew. That's where you really dig into the ideas in depth. I'm not a philosopher. Listening to this show is not the same as listening to Leonard Peikoff talk about philosophy. All right, you should do both. You should do both. And you should encourage your friends to listen to the show. But this show is going to become more and more of a show for objectivists, more and more of a show, you know, for the objectivist community, let's call it. And the second show, which will launch June 18th, will be more of a show targeted externally. We'll be educating about basic ideas in philosophy and linking them up aggressively, much more comprehensively to covered events, more than I do here. All right. I will talk to you probably next time from Israel. We'll see about the internet connection there. I'm staying with family, and I'm not sure they have wired internet. If not, then definitely from London next weekend, probably on, Sunday or Saturday next week from there. And then I'm back in the U.S. and also see you guys, hopefully. Hopefully you guys have signed up for OCON. I think it's going to be a fabulous, terrific objectivist conference this year in Pittsburgh. If you haven't signed up, it's not too late. You can show up. You can come. You should come. It's going to be terrific. So join me. Next week, in 3 weeks at OCON in Pittsburgh. All right, I'll talk to you from Israel, and if not, from London. See you all soon. This is the Yaron Brook signing off with this music.